Live conversation. Live Conversations Radio. Be the change you want to see. Live Conversations Radio. Be the change you want to see.
And welcome to Peace Talks on Life Conversations Radio. We have an exciting show for you today. My guest today is Hank Wasserman, who is a paleoanthropologist. Dr. Wasserman is a cutting-edge scientist who walks in many worlds, and he did his undergraduate work and master's degree in zoology at the University of Colorado at Boulder, then served in the U.S. Peace Corps, living among peoples of the Yoruba tribe in Nigeria, where he first became interested in indigenous spiritual traditions. Today, as a shamanic practitioner and teacher, we have the honor of talking to Dr. Wesselman about his latest book, The Bowl of Light. And what fascinates me most is the fact that he's talking about a very dear elder, now ancestor, friend, teacher, Mr. Haile Makua. And we're going to talk more about that right now, an excerpt from Ashe to get us in the right framework.
The world is hungry. The world is needing healing. The world is needing a beings are poisoned by fear. There are certain powers that we have lost, honorable. How shall we get them? And give them to our children.
This is a spiritual gathering. I want to, like, have people look at it more as a way of life, because if you live your everyday life like that, it's not spiritual. Because if you're talking about your spiritual to me, that means it's a separation. This is a difference from the way you live your life than when you're doing spirit work. And if you come to me saying you're doing spirit work, that means it's a time when you're not.
You see, young people don't believe that they can do all this. In fact, in my mind, it was no problem to manifest anything. It's when you become intellectual, then you start to think, the doubt. Well, can I do that? It's like when I learned how to parachute. I wasn't worried about the first jump. In fact, I was so excited, I wanted to do it. It was the second jump, because now I think, wow, what if all these other things happen? Am I ready to do this? See, I got back in my mind, set up in my heart. In my heart, I knew I could do it. But I got back in my head, and that's where all my elders said, separation lives here. Corporation lives here. So, this is a place of choice. Choose. Where is it that you want to live? Here or here? Choose. Where is it that you want to live? Here or here?
Indeed, where is it that you want to live? Here in the head or here in the heart? From Mr. Haile Mokua. Hank Wesselman, are you online with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
I certainly can. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. You know,
great.
How does the sound sound? You know, I've got an active volcano in my front yard, you know, and you always feel a little concerned about that.
Well, actually, I can hear it. I can hear you very well.
That's great.
And with you standing there with a volcano, you bring the energy of Pele right into our show, so I think that is absolutely wonderful and appropriate, given that we're talking about Mr. Mokua.
Well, Mokua called her Mama, and he made his prayers to her every morning at his office, which was right at the edge of the crater of Kilauea. And this is where our friendship really began. I was giving a talk at an institute up in Waimea on the Big Island in 1996 after my first book, Spirit Walker, came out. And he came to look me over. You know, I was aware of the fact that this might happen because in that book, I don't know if you ever read Spirit Walker, but it's the story of how I went crazy in Hawaii back in the 1980s and began to have these spontaneous visionary experiences in which my conscious awareness was re-geographied into the mind and body of another man who lives in a different slice of time. And, you know, I wasn't aware of it at first, but this was going to develop into an ongoing continuum of visions. And as it turns out, this man is very likely one of my descendants, or to be more precise, my descendant self. And so here I was involved as a research scientist, no less, you know, having these spontaneous visions for which nothing in my training as an anthropology prepared me. So, you know, I began to write this stuff up like I would write up field work, and when Spirit Walker was finally published by Bantam Books, it made a tremendous impression. In fact, it was eventually published in 13 languages. And Mokua read it, and he was very involved with the ancestral field himself. I mean, he was constantly being advised by his ancestors in spirit. So I didn't know it, but he and I shared that in common, this ancestral field work, so to speak. So in 1996, in December, I was giving this talk at this institute, and he showed up with a group of these spiritual warriors, the Nakoa. And I think they really came to look me over and see if I was real. And, you know, this could be a little unnerving. I mean, wouldn't you be a little unnerved if a kahuna of Mokua stature showed up to look you over?
Absolutely. And, having been with him, warriors, I can certainly, understand what that must have felt like.
Well, as some of your listeners may be aware, those who've seen The Ball of Light, Haile Mokua had this exceptional genealogy, this pedigree. He was a warrior chief, and he had King Kamehameha himself in his ancestry on his mother's side, and High Chief Keuwa on his ancestry on his father's side. And so there are very few people in Polynesia with that kind of genealogy. So in Polynesia, where genealogy is everything, it determines your mana, your personal creative power, it determines your ike, your ancestral wisdom that you receive directly through your ancestral lineage. He was known all over Polynesia. I mean, when he'd get off the plane in Tahiti, he'd be mobbed at the airport by people who wanted to talk to him, who wanted to see him, who wanted to touch him, feed him, take care of him, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And, you know, in his later years, he traveled extensively, care of the Ford Foundation, to speak with the Native American nations, and went all the way to Africa three times to speak to a lot of the chiefly people in that part of the world. He even sat on stage with the Dalai Lama at the United Nations in New York. So he became a world figure in his later years. In other words, this wasn't just any kahuna who'd come to look me over. This was the big kahuna.
In many ways.
You know,
yes.
So I breathed a short prayer before I gave my talk. I was giving a talk on the transformational community. That's us. You know, that's you and I and all the people who like your show and read my books and so forth and so on. And as a social scientist, as an anthropologist, I'm very interested in these people and their beliefs, their values, and trends. And so I gave a rather academic talk that day. But during my talk, I got this feeling that there was something that Makua had come to say. So he's watching me throughout my talk, and I'm beginning to get this feeling, you know, that's coming. But I don't know what the protocol is. And for indigenous elders, as you know, protocol is everything.
Yeah.
So I turned to him and I said, Elder Makua, you know, I'm getting this feeling that there's something that you wish to say. Would it be correct for me to invite you to speak? Well, what he did is he momentarily blanked out, and I watched him. I watched him connect with his inner sources of wisdom and power. I watched him connect with his ancestral spirits for advice. And when he reemerged, he stood up. Now, Mako was about, he was close to 6.5 feet tall. So, I mean, this was a very impressive man with a great big beard that tumbled down his chest and a great big ponytail down his back and a flashy aloha shirt and a carved walking stick. And so he looked at me across the room and he said, a friend of mine sent me your book. And I read it. Silence in the room. I mean, this was high noon in Polynesia. You know, this was the moment of truth. He said, I read it again just to make sure I got it right. And then I went down to the beach and I took your book and I put it down on the sand and I called in the ancestors and we had a talk about you. He smiled at me and he said, the ancestors asked me what your name is. And I said, your name is Wesselman, Hank Wesselman. He smiled again. He said, the ancestors told me I wasn't pronouncing your name right. They said your name is really Wesselman, that you're a vessel like the canoe. Now, I'm saying that from a place of sharing, not from a place of ego. I was sort of floored by this because, you know, I'd been expecting him to say something like, you know, you're not Hawaiian. You really shouldn't be writing about us. And he would have been fully in his rights to do so. But on this occasion, you know, he just laughed with his clairvoyance. Of course, he was reading what was going through my mind. He said, oh, don't worry. We Hawaiians don't write. We talk and we share what we find in our hearts with each other. But in your culture, it's the tradition to write. And so the ancestors have told me to say to you in front of all these people here that everything you wrote in your book, Spirit Walker, is true. And we Hawaiians support you. Keep spreading the word. You're making our job easier. Well, you know, the emotion of the moment was really something. I mean, people were weeping. And it was the beginning of a most interesting friendship that extended over the last 8 years of Makua's life. And during this time, he and I had some extraordinary conversations, you know, kind of like, you know, I wouldn't compare myself to Plato, but you remember Plato's dialogues with Socrates?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, these are not unlike that in many ways.
You know, one of the most memorable moments that I have with Mr. Makua, Hank, was we were in South Africa at Baba Credo Mutwa's.
Uh-huh.
And Baba asked Mr. Makua and Auntie Poi Poi to speak in the ancient Hawaiian language. And he spoke in the ancient Zulu language. And they were able to understand each other. it was just an incredible moment to see that happen, to be in the midst of that. And so I just wanted to mention that, because as you were talking about him and him affirming you in what you're doing in front of, you know, in front of everyone, as though to make sure that, you know, it was very clear that you were making his job easier, because you were bringing forward truly that which was what was within him. Those moments are so incredible that they never leave you.
No,
and I really appreciated that when I was reading that in your book. I mean, you just took me right back there with him. You know?
He told me about that meeting with Credo Mutua. I didn't know that Annie Poipoi was there. You know, I met her in New York many years ago. She's passed again as well.
Yes.
You know, she passed about the same time Makua passed.
Let me ask just for clarification for our listening audience. I know that you talk about shamanism. Let's talk a little bit about that to give a clear understanding, because for different people, that means different things. And I think that's really important. As I was reading your book, shamanism stood out for me, as well as a concept that you introduced that I'd like to hear more about, the authentic initiation and then the bowl of light. Those three things. Can we kind of talk about those three?
We certainly could. The word shaman is a word that was chosen by anthropologists from the Tungus language of the Siberian peoples. It was given a very precise definition to accurately describe individuals in tribal societies, as a rule, traditional societies, who perform sacred responsibilities on behalf of members of their communities, usually as a part-timer. In other words, they're not full-time priests or religious practitioners. Now, if we examine the word shaman, there's a lot of confusion in the Western world between the kind of work that shamans do and the kind of work that medicine people or priests do. And this confusion exists because every shaman is a medicine person, but not all medicine people are priests, are shamans.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in my experience, most medicine people I've crossed trails with are not shamans, but they fulfill social roles more like those of priests, in the sense that they serve as ceremonial leaders, as ritual leaders, as well as healers who come from their place of knowledge about how to use the plant medicines and so forth and so on. But you see, the medicine person does their main work in this world here, in this world of things seen. Now, in a traditional society, they understand that the world is made up of two halves, a world of things seen and a world of things hidden, and they make no distinction between them. They understand that they reflect each other. In other words, this world is a reflection of the spirit world or dream world from which it was sourced. And what happens in this world is reflected back into the spirit world, and they shapeshift in response to each other. So the shaman is an individual, usually somebody who grows up in a tribal society who is able to see into the realm of things hidden. They're seers. And they discover that they have this ability, often as children, in which they can see and encounter things, levels of reality, and beings that nobody else can see. The shaman is an individual who learns how to alter their consciousness or expand their conscious awareness so that they can perceive the world of things hidden. And the first thing they discover is that that world is inhabited. It's inhabited by transpersonal forces that they call spirits. Transpersonal meaning that they're not conjured up in the mind of the person who sees them, that these are beings, imaginal beings, who have their own reality, quite separate of the one who perceives them. So what kind of spirits would you find? Well, you'd find the spirits of the elements, the spirits of the elementals, the spirits of nature, the spirits of animals and plants and trees. You find the spirits of the ancestors with whom Makua was in such ongoing contact, the spirits of dead people who are discarnate, as well as the higher organizing intelligences that people anthropomorphize as winged superhumans called angels, the angelic forces. Now, these realms in the dream world are organized in layers, into the classic lower, middle, and upper worlds. The lower worlds are the dreaming of nature, and all of the nature spirits are located there. In other words, if you want to connect with the spirit of eagle or bear or oak tree or willow, you would go into the lower worlds, into the mythic lower worlds. And those worlds are much like this world right here, in the sense that you can really get your toes into them. The middle world is the middle world of dream. It's the world of things hidden that reflects everything in our physical world, everyday reality world. And this is the level in which we pass when we make transition. These are the transitional worlds that the Tibetan Buddhists call the bardos, or the Christians call purgatory. The upper worlds are the archetypal source of those realms which are called heaven or paradise in the Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions. And this is where we have the higher organizing intelligences, including the archangelic forces, many of whom are in relationship with human beings who are devoted to contributing to the greater good, especially to the greater whole, if I could put it that way. I'm talking whole, a greater entirety. And I suppose the most complete greater whole that we could consider is the soul of this world, the world soul, which the Gnostics called the Sophia and the Greeks called Gaia, the world soul. So these higher organizing intelligences are more inclined to come into relationship with human beings who are oriented towards contributing to the greater good of their communities, of their societies, and to the world soul itself. The shaman is the one who, through relationship with these archetypal forces, is able to do various things, initially on behalf of themselves, and then increasingly on behalf of others. Now, in this sense, Makua was a shaman in every sense, and when he took me to his office at the volcano crater, before we talked, he invited his ancestors to come and witness what we were going to speak about on that day. And so I watched him blank out and then start to chant his ancestral lineage. And as he did, as these names flowed across his tongue and out into the air, I watched him as he was actually physically morphing in a very subtle way. What he was doing is he was using his body and his mind to create a bridge between the personal world of form and the transpersonal world of spirit. And once he had created that bridge, his ancestors were able to cross that bridge into our world, into this world right here, in order to be part of what was going to transpire on that day. And so, in talking about Makua as a Hawaiian shaman, there are a lot of people who might object to that. There are a lot of ethnic purists who say, well, nobody can be a shaman unless you come from Siberia and you're a traditional tribal person. I would beg to disagree. You know, as an anthropologist who has been involved in this field for more than 30 years now, it is my impression that the shaman is a universal figure found in all of the world societies. And in some, the shamans are the most important people in their communities because it's in their capable hands that the physical as well as the metaphysical equilibrium of their communities rests. In other societies like our own, people with shamanic abilities tend to keep a fairly low profile because of certain unfortunate events that happened largely between 1500 and 1650. I'm talking about the great witch hunts when the Catholic Church took it upon itself to eliminate the competition and killed somewhere between 300,000 and 9 million people, most of whom were women, who were traditional shamanic practitioners in every sense of the word. So the shaman, interestingly, is an individual who has these extraordinary abilities. And, you know, speaking in all humility, I discovered that I had them when I was a child, but I had no idea what they were. I also discovered after my father had passed that they ran in my family, and I got it from my father. I got the ability from my father, who had a very active relationship with one of his ancestors. That's something I wrote about in my trilogy, Spirit Walker, Medicine Maker, and Vision Seeker. I wrote about my father's ability to translocate temporally across time, which is apparently what I have the ability to do as well. It tends to be a spontaneous experience, But what I've done is I've created training workshops across the years to invite other Western mystics, non-tribal people all, to come in to sharpen their abilities so that they can function in this capacity on behalf of themselves and on behalf of their communities as well. And it was in inviting Makua to attend our events in Hawaii that he really was able to see what my wife Jill and I were doing. And he perceived us as being part of something he called the ancestral grand plan. Of course, I didn't know that in the beginning at all. He saw it right from the beginning.
Ancestral grand plan. He spoke about that often. But before we talk more about that, let's move now into authentic initiation. What when you talk about authentic initiation, what exactly is that?
Well, in my discussions with Makua across the years, he used to talk about the fact that in order to experience authentic initiation, we have to know who we are. If you don't know who you are, you haven't been authentically initiated. And it's been my experience in the training workshops that we do that, you know, a great many people in the Western world, you know, people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, are still in search of authentic initiation. Now, the two big questions that Makua used to ask, and this is something we address in the Bowl of Light, the first question is, who are you? And the second question is, where are you? You have to be able to answer those questions. Now, in relation to the question, who are you, one of the things that Makua revealed is that in the monotheistic perspective, okay, monotheism dominates Western culture. In monotheism, we have one soul, we have one life, and we have one God. But in the traditional tribal perspective, we have many souls. We have many lives spread out across the time-space continuum, and there are many transpersonal forces with whom we can come into relationship. Now, in talking about the nature of the soul, Makua revealed that in the Hawaiian kahuna perspective, each one of us has not one, but three distinct souls. To be precise, we have a spiritual soul which is immortal, that doesn't die, that travels across time. We have a body soul that runs the physical body, and we have a mental soul that we develop in each life. In the Western tradition, Pythagoras, the Greek philosopher and mathematician Pythagoras, was the first one to really write about this, because Pythagoras was not only a shaman, but he was an embodiment of the god Apollo. In other words, Pythagoras was Apollo. This is a very interesting story, which is explored by Peter Kingsley in his book, A Story Waiting to Pierce You, for those of you out there who've read this book. It's really quite astonishing. But Pythagoras was the one in the Western tradition who wrote about the three principias, and it's from this that we get this whole perception of body, mind, spirit, the three principal aspects of the self. In the Kahuna tradition, some people will call these self aspects, with a high self, middle self, and low self. But in fact, Makua was quite firm in his expression of the fact that these are actually souls. And they're souls because they're all derived from the same source, but they exist in very different states of quality and function. For example, in the reincarnational cycle, and this is all explored in the Bowl of Light, as you know, in the reincarnational cycle, each one of us is sourced into this world by a higher self that the Hawaiians call Aumakua, with a capital A. Aumakua is the utterly trustworthy ancestral spirit self. The spirit self, the spirit soul divides itself, the higher self divides itself and sends in a seed of its light, actually a bowl of its light, which is where the book derives its title from. And this seed of light takes up residence within us when we draw our first breath. The breath is actually the vehicle of transfer of the bowl of light from the higher self into the new embodiment when we draw our first breath. Now, when that seed of light arrives, it discovers a distinct and separate soul which is already in residence. This is the soul of the body soul or physical soul, which the Hawaiians called unihipili, a word that has many meanings according to how it's used. Now, the body soul is responsible for generating our emotions and feelings, which is why Deepak calls it the emotional body. It's also the source of our memories because it accesses our memories which are stored in our energetic matrix. The entire operation of the physical body is under its direct control, including the physical body's repair and restoration. This is where that inner healer is located, which all true healers know about. The body soul is the perceiver. It's the perceiver of the outer world in which we act, as well as the inner world in which we think, feel, and dream. The body soul is thus the interface between ourself and the other. So it's the aspect of our soul complex through which all psychic experience and all shamanic experience is achieved. Its prime directive is to grow, to increase, become more. It reasons, and it reasons logically. You know, you only put your finger in a candle flame once. And like a good personal computer or a good servant, it does what it's told. Now, the master soul is the mental soul. And in children, the mental soul, which the Hawaiians called uhane, is well in the background during the early life of the individual because it grows in response to life as we live it. The mental soul is the aspect of ourself that thinks, integrates, makes decisions. It's our inner director, our inner chief, our inner CEO. It assigns meaning to things. It's the source of our intentionality and our volition. It's the source of our creative imagination, which is the key to understanding that we are actually gods in training. This is the subject of a long discussion I had with Makua in 2001-2002, and it's the last conversation in the book on becoming gods, which you've already read, obviously. But, you know, understanding how these three souls come together to create the self is pivotal to understanding who we are. The oversoul, the higher self, is the source of our intuition, of our inspiration. It's the self aspect that sends us dreams and visions and ideas in response to our need to know. And as such, it serves as the source of all the information we might ever have need of during our lifetime. But it never tells us what to do. It'll provide that information if you ask it, and you ask it in the right way. So establishing a good working relationship with your higher self is absolutely essential, especially from Makua's perspective, and it's something that we talked about. So understanding that we have not one soul, but actually three souls who come together in a personal soul cluster is essential to understanding that first question, who are you? Then, of course, at the end of life, the soul complex composed of those three soul aspects detaches with the last breath, when we release our breath, our last breath. And eventually, having gone through the bardo experience of the transitional worlds and adjusting to the new state that we find ourselves in and doing our past life review, all of this is well known to mystics in all cultures. It does eventually ascend and rise out of the transitional worlds and return to its source in the upper worlds, its source being the higher self, into which everything we have done and become and endured during life is archived, kind of like a DVD. So Hank Wesselman will only be here once, but, you know, Hank Wesselman is an immortal in the sense that everything I am will be archived into my higher self at life's end. And it's in that matrix, so to speak, that I join the ancestors and my own personal ancestors, because each one of these former selves could be considered to be a spiritual ancestor. So this, you know, from Makua's perspective, was very interesting. It revealed that we had actually three ancestral lineages. There's your mother's lineage, there's your father's lineage, and then there's your own personal lineage, which is archived into your higher self. Three ancestral lineages. It's quite a different perspective from what we have in Judeo-Christianity, isn't it?
It certainly is. And then, of course, the next question becomes, since we start talking about, you know, moving into that higher plane or the ancestral realm, let's talk a moment. I know in the book you mentioned, and in our conversation when you first started, you talked about the chant and how he just literally saw him morphing through this lineage as he chanted his lineage. I also have heard other shaman in other cultures do the same thing. And there's one thing that I found in common, regardless of if I was in Australia, India, Africa, here, Polynesia, is that chant that literally goes back to the source of creation always takes them right back to the stars. And I was wondering if we could talk about that.
We certainly could. There's a little chapter in The Bowl of Light in which he talks about the star people and the fact that humanity actually came from out of another dimension and across the universe from the stars, and that we were brought here by high guardians who knew the purpose of our destiny. We were brought here to this beautiful planet to embody and life forms that were ready to receive us. Now, there was a very interesting story, and Makua told me this story in response to his asking me what I do as an anthropologist. And as some of your listeners are aware, I work in Africa as a member of an international team of scientists exploring the fossil beds of the Great Rift Valley in search of answers to the mystery of human origins. I've been doing this since 1971, so it's 40 years now that I've been involved in this quest. And I go out into the desert with my fellow treasure hunters, so to speak, investigators, paleontologists, archaeologists, geologists, in search of the ancestors. This was something that Maku and I shared in common. So in his telling me the story of what Polynesian people understand, he said, you know, we originally came from the stars. We were brought here. And when you get back to 18.5 million years ago, that's where you'll find me. Well, this was a very interesting thing for him to say, because 18.5 million years ago is a period of time known to science as the Miocene period. To be precise, the earlier part of the Miocene, which was a very long geological epoch that started about 25 million years ago and ended about 5.5 million years ago. Well, during that time, the plants and animals had a very, very different look to them than they have today. For example, there were no hippopotamuses. There were creatures called anthracotheres, which were proto-hippos. There were no true dogs and cats as we know them today, but there were proto-dogs and cats. In other words, the fauna that we take for granted today was in the process of coming into being at that time. And so in these great tropical forests which blanketed the world was a greenhouse world in the early Miocene with no ice at the poles. Sea levels were probably 300 feet higher, and the tropical forests extended up to the Arctic Circle. So in these tropical forests lived a group of proto-anthropoid apes called the Dryopithecines by science. Now, they looked actually more like monkeys than apes because they didn't arm swing underneath branches. They actually walked on top of branches rather like monkeys, but they lacked tails. And you will have noticed during this life that none of our fellow human beings are sporting tails, at least none that we can see. That's because the physical body that we're inhabiting is descended from that original Dryopithecine stock from 18.5 million years ago. Now, McCoy didn't know anything about paleontology, but I do, because that's my field. And so I was actually rather stunned that he would sort of earmark this particular time at the time we were brought here from the stars. And he said, because there were early life forms that were ready to receive us, we descended as souls. We didn't come here as aliens. We didn't come here in spaceships. We came here in what he called canoes made of light. In other words, we came as seeds of light across the universe. And once we took up residence in these primitive bodies, we forgot who we were and where we came from. And so he said that some of the guardians who had brought us here embodied as well, so that they would be here when we were ready to receive the knowledge of our purpose and our destiny. And then when we were ready to receive that, they gave it to us, and most of them left at that point. But then he also confessed that some of them are still here. So, in my mind, I was listening to this account, and I thought to myself, high guardians coming across the universe, embodying here, they would probably embody in sentient life forms, in self-aware life forms with large brains. So I began to scan the fauna of the early Miocene, which I can do. And I didn't get very far down my scan before I suddenly found them. The cetaceans. The very first modern whales and dolphins occur in the early Miocene. Now, we have primitive whales that go back to the Eocene, to 15 million years ago. They don't look much like whales, but that's what they were. And we have primitive primates that go back to the early Eocene. But the first really modern cetaceans occur in the early Miocene. And as I'm thinking about this, Makua, in his clairvoyance, looks at me and says, "You got it." He'd been following my thought line the entire time, you know. My wife Jill was with us, and she didn't know what I'd been thinking about, so I had to give her a quick recap. And at the end of that time, I said to him, "The whales and the dolphins are the guardians who came with us across the universe." And that's interesting because, as you know, people that visit Hawaii and other places often swim with wild dolphins or swim with whales, and there's this interesting telepathic rapport that seems to exist between us. I remember swimming with wild dolphins in Kealakekua Bay 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and I would be looking down through this incredibly clear blue water at a dolphin who's down there about 100, 150 feet below me, and she looks small, and she's got a little calf with her. And I think to myself, boy, I'd sure like to have a look at that calf. And suddenly she makes this right-hand turn, and within moments I'm eyeball to eyeball with her and her calf. I mean, things like that happen on a regular basis.
Yes, yes.
So when Makua told me about the whales and the dolphins, I asked him, I said, "What was the knowledge that they passed to us about our purpose and our destiny?" And he looked at me and smiled and said, "The knowledge is twofold. It's two-pronged. First of all, we were brought here to enjoy ourselves. We were brought here to grow, increase, and become more in the beauty of nature on this wonderful world. And secondly, we're to remember who we really are. We're to remember our divine origins, and that can only happen in one way, through the experience of love for one another." So that's the whole thing. We were brought here to enjoy ourselves, number one, and we were brought here to love each other. And all the rest, all the careers and friendships and relationships and acquisitions and all of that stuff, that's just the flow of life. That's just the river in which we can go with the flow. As Makua used to say, we can go nalu with a big laugh, or we can fight our way upstream, in which case we have lessons to learn, and we do eventually learn them. But, you know, it's interesting, like people elsewhere, like the Dogon in Africa. You know, Kua traced his lineage back to Sirius, to the star A-A, because he was Water Clan. He was a Water Clan person, and he said all the Water Clan people came from Sirius.
That's right. In fact, when you were talking about the dolphin, I was thinking about the Dogon, who talk about the four pair of dolphins who came here that seeded humankind, the original ancestors. Was it the Nomo, I think? I don't know.
The Nomo. And they look like fish.
Yes, yes.
They either look like fish or they were amphibians. It's hard to say, but the Dogon say they look like fish.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I was thinking about that when you were talking, about that period of time. The other thing I meant to mention, Hank, when you were talking about who are you, you know, that question, no matter where I was with Mr. Makua, he would always, you know, the first question is, who are you? And we were in South Africa, and we were out on this reserve where this family of baboons lived. And so he was sitting in a chair by a pool one day, and this old man baboon just comes and just plops down in the chair next to him and crosses his arms. And Mr. Makua leaned over to him and said, "Who are you?" And this baboon turned a backflip off that chair, kicked the chair, and was so angry. And Mr. Makua just laughed, you know, but it was, then he ran off into the woods and came back and sat down again, and Mr. Makua leaned over to him again and said, "Who are you?" You know, and he had pretty much the same reaction in that time, ran out into the woods and never came back. I thought that was really, it was so funny to hear Mr. Makua tell that, you know?
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
That would have made a wonderful picture. I wonder if anybody got a photograph.
Absolutely, if we'd only had that one on film.
Oh, wow.
Now, we only have about 10 minutes left on the show, and one of the things I wanted to do, ask you a couple of questions in terms of your relationship with Mr. McCool. How did that shape you or change you or move you to the point where you are now? And then what do you think the significance of him leaving us so quickly in that moment of his transition? What did he leave us with?
Well, you know, we reshaped ourselves in response to each other, I would have to say, in all honesty. Because, you know, I was already a spiritual teacher when I met Makua, and he was aware of that, and I was working in the shamanic tradition, and he was aware of what this was. And so over the years that we had our wonderful talks, which are recorded in our book, I watched him as his ideas shifted in response to mine, and of course, my ideas shifted enormously in response to him and his knowledge that he shared with me. Since I met him in 1996, you know, Jill and I have been carrying some of his teachings out into the world, which can be shared in the oral tradition. There are things that we teach in our workshops which are not included in the Bowl of Light because, in a sense, they're kapu, they're sacred, and they should only be shared with those who are ready to receive them and in the oral tradition, which is the way it's usually done. So both of us, I think, responded very strongly to each other, and in gratitude, I suppose, Makua gave me one of his walking sticks about 8 months before he passed. Now, I don't know if this was done because he already foresaw his passing, what was coming up, but I do know that he had said to someone else shortly after he'd given me his walking stick that he felt that his earth walk was done, that he had done his work, and that this earth walk was coming to a close. When he did pass, he'd spent the last week of his life with us at one of our gatherings in Waimea, and he held forth on the ancestral plan and kept everybody just riveted, as he usually did at his talks when he held forth. And, you know, a lot of that is recorded in the book for people who are interested in Kahuna wisdom. But, you know, Makua, on that last night of his life, showed me a box of his writings, his written writings on pads of paper, on yellow pads. He brought forward this cardboard box from the back of his car with about 30, 40 pads in it. And I'm in the process now of absorbing the knowledge on those writings. Makua said to me on that last evening, he said, you know, you've asked me to write a book with you for years, and I've always politely refused because it was not my kuleana, it was not my responsibility to do that. And he said, but I'm going to pass these written teachings to you because you're going to know how to handle them. He also looked at me very seriously and he said, you know, I know that you're going to write about me and you're going to write about our friendship. And this was as it was meant to happen. He saw this book, The Bowl of Light, as a very strong contribution to what he called the ancestral plan. And the ancestral plan, as you know, the first two goals of the plan involve, first of all, those activities that will expand the spiritual awareness of humankind. This is very, very important. This is a time for intense spiritual growth and the opportunities that are available to us at this time, because we're coming to the end of a cycle, are huge. The second goal of the plan involves all the spiritual elders, all the teachers, coming together to meet each other, to create community, to bring their initiates and family members and community members together, because the time of separation is over. We're going into the new cycle now, and the new cycle is about creating connection, not about creating separation. And so he saw the work that Jill and I were doing as part of this plan, because what we do is we bring people into connection with their inner sources of wisdom and power. And, you know, those who are interested in what we do can go to our website, sharedwisdom.com, shared wisdom with a D, sharedwisdom.com, and see what we're actually involved with. And Makua's contribution to these seminars was enormous, because we've been able to bring through a lot of his wisdom And in fact, in these training programs, his footprint is very strong. You know, his presence is very strong. And in fact, although he's on the other side of the mirror now, in the opening ritual, I always invite him in case he would like to come, because he loved these workshops. He loved these gatherings. He would just get high as a kite, because we were all in his perspective at what he called the sixth level. The sixth level is the level of the peacemaker, the level of the medicine person, the level of the healer, the priest, the priestess. And this is the level that we're going into now. We're out of the fifth level, which was about the time of Ku, the time of the warrior, and we're going into the time of Lono. And Lono is the peacemaker, the god of agriculture and navigation and science and meteorology. He's the weatherman, that kind of stuff. Lono was actually a man once, and he was actually Makua's ancestor, as you read in the book.
Yes.
So, you know, Makua is very, very aware of the fact that what I was doing and what he were doing was doing, they were converging on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book, the Bowl of Light, is really a collaboration between the two of us, because he began to appear in my mind about a year after his passing, kind of like a presence, you know, and we began to have these conversations, very much like we had them in life, and I began to bring this information back in blocks and to take notes on what we were talking about. And so the Bowl of Light, I suppose you could call it channeled teachings, although it's really not. It's really derived from my memories of the times that we spent together, because we did over 18 workshops at which he came as the visiting scholar across
mm-hmm.
those years. And
right.
so a lot of that information is just thoroughly ingrained within me now.
So well,
I've changed considerably.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, having known Mr. McCord, I read your book, I was so grateful because I think you just, excuse me, channeled through his spirit so completely. As you were talking, I was thinking about a time when he was talking about, you know, the new spiritual warrior. And if I could just share just a few lines from his teachings on that, that just really bring home what you were saying. He said, to be a spiritual warrior, especially as a caretaker, now you have to live according to the ancestral kapu, meaning you have to live according to the way the ancestors behaved during their lifetime, meaning love all that you see, live what you feel, and know all that you possess. These are the three kapu, sacred orders to protect the flow of mana, that they have to abide by being a spiritual warrior. And if your ego is still flaring up, 9 times out of 10, you will pack up your stuff and leave, because it is not exciting to you to be a spiritual warrior. It doesn't have the kind of excitement like how you see in normal warriors that are still in the coercion, because they have to shift out of there into the positive polarity, which is persuasion. They are now to persuade, to teach, and to be healers. And as you were talking, you know, I just remembered him saying that, and you captured it when you talk about moving from the fifth to the to now we're in the sixth, you know, the time of Lono. And so I'm really, as I said before, I'm very grateful that you are bringing his teachings forward in such a powerful way, Hank, and I mean that from my heart.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm, and I'm very grateful that you took the time to be on our program with us today. And I want to give you an opportunity, as we're coming to the end of the show now, to share anything that you feel is that you maybe you haven't had a chance to say yet, but to inspire our listening audience into their true shamanic self.
Well, in terms of the true shamanic self, the old Oglala Sioux shaman and medicine man, Black Elk, said
mm-hmm.
something rather extraordinary 60 years ago, just before his passing. He said, and he's the one who essentially wrote the book Black Elk Speaks with an anthropologist, as well as the book The Sacred Pipe with another mm-hmm. anthropologist. Both of these are classics in Native American literature. He said that as we come to the end of this cycle of ages, that the primordial spirituality would reemerge and reestablish itself and it would be on this foundation that the next cycle of ages would be built. The primordial spirituality is the shaman's path. And what's happening is that there's a new kind of spirituality which is coming into being in our time. The old monotheistic traditions are failing us. They're failing to solve the problems that they've created. And many have observed that virtually all the problems in the world today have been generated by organized religion. You know, Makua put it this way. He said that organized religion has, on the whole, been a serious impediment to human advancement. And so what's happening is there's a new spiritual practice which is coming into being, in which everyone has the ability as well as the responsibility to become their own teacher, their own guru, their own priest, their own priestess, achieving that direct transpersonal connection with the inner sources of wisdom and power that defines the shaman, that defines the mystic. This is extraordinarily easy to do. And if you look at the last 40 years, since the works of Carlos Castaneda came out in the 60s, that's precisely what happened. There were initially just a few teachers of shamanism at large in the world, if I could put it that way. And now there are about a dozen of us who are traveling around the country, nationally and internationally even, doing training workshops for non-Western tribal people to bring them into those connections. And so this is the epicenter of the new spiritual practice which is coming into being. And it will most likely replace all of our mainstream modern religions within the next 100 years or so. That's my guess.
And I have one quick question in regards to that. As we look at the world and where we are right now, do you think that's the energy that's going to pull us forward?
Well, it's the great unraveling, isn't it? You know, when you come to the end of a cycle, this is the end of a 26,000-year cycle, according to the Maya, and according to Makua as well. And he said that with the ending of the cycle, everything would start to unravel. And in fact, it has, and it still is. And it's not over. We got another year to go, another year and a half to go. But what will happen is that as things get worse and worse and worse, there will be a moment when everything stops. And then the spiral will begin to expand outwards again. And initially, it will happen very quickly. What will become the foundation for that next cycle is outlined in our chapter called The Ancestral Grand Plan, because this is what Makua was sketching out. He was sketching out a foundation for the next cycle. And it's very important, because what we build on that foundation will form the shape of the world's lifeways and spiritual practice for much of the next several thousand years, and that's not a small thing.
Right. Okay. Well, Hank, thank you so much for being on Peace Talks today. I think your show will be very inspiring to so many people. In fact, we'll probably play it several times to make sure we fill our audience with all of this wisdom that you've shared on in just this short one-hour period. I hope that we can continue to talk, and I will definitely be in touch. And once I finish this walk in November, perhaps I can have an opportunity to visit one of your workshops or seminars somewhere in the country.
You'll be welcome.
Well, take good care. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, I will be at the Omega Institute on the weekend of September 23rd to 25th. That's in your neck of the woods.
Say that one more time.
One more time. The Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, September 23rd to 25th. I'm going to be co-teaching a workshop with Sandra Ingerman called Awakening to the Spirit World. So that's maybe something you can check in on.
I certainly shall. And let's give you a website one more time, Hank.
SharedWisdom.com, SharedWisdom, SharedWisdom.com.
And I encourage everyone who's listening to the show today to purchase The Bowl of Light, your latest book, and enjoy the ancestral wisdom that Hank shared with our dear friend, elder, ancestor, Mr. Haile Makua. You've been listening to Peace Talks on Life Conversations Radio. We look forward to being with you every Friday on the noon hour, and we will be with you next Friday as we will talk with organizers of the Sai Baba Foundation Walk for Values in Washington, D.C., scheduled for the 4th of September. Until then, have a great week, and do not hesitate to tap in to that higher self that is awakening in all of us and giving us the guidepost to move forward in this tremendous opportunity for humanity to evolve. In peace, this is Audrey Scott Williams. Until next Friday.
Life Conversations Radio. Be the change you want to see.